I am Hans.
And I am Franz, and we just want to pop your lock.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, we're back. This is hour two. It goes by quickly, so if you want to get on the air, give me a call, 888-914-9149. Keep in mind also that everything I cite by way of articles, etc., those are all posted on the show Twitter feed at PMadridShow, which is embedded at relevantradio.com/Patrick. So that can be your one-stop shop if you want to find everything there. If you want to send me an email, you can go there as well and just click on links, and you'll be able to send me an email and express yourself, as the song says. Okay, so Maria, just before we took our break, you were asking a question about, did the church ever have, I think you put, did the church ever have restrictions or something in its law about minors getting married? Was that your question?
Yes.
Okay. So, because we ran out of time, I didn't have a chance to give you the specifics, but here they are. Okay, so first of all, in the church's canon law, children, young people, minors, depending on how you want to use it, are not permitted to get married and can't be validly married if the male is under 16 years of age and the female is under 14 years of age. So the canon law is 16 and above for males and 14 and above for females. And that would be what the minimum age that's required. Now, the church does not encourage this, but it sets the bar at that level, saying anyone below that, if you're 15, you know, Romeo and Juliet, 15 years old, sorry, you can't enter into a valid marriage. You're too young. So that's what the law says. Now, let me share with you from one of my favorite authors on the topic of the sacraments, Father Nicholas Halligan, OP. He's a Dominican friar. And in his works on the church's teaching on the sacraments, he says the following. He says, the church directs her pastors to dissuade minors from contracting marriage without the knowledge or or contrary to the reasonable opposition of their parents. If they nevertheless insist on going ahead, the pastor may not lawfully assist without previously consulting with the local ordinary. So in other words, if the, you know, the 17-year-old and 16-year-old girl, 17-year-old boy, 16-year-old girl say, look, we really want to get married, our parents are against it, the priest cannot celebrate Mass for them. Cannot officiate at their wedding without first consulting the bishop. Then you would have to get the go-ahead from the bishop. In ecclesiastical law, a person is a minor until his 21st birthday. The age in law, in civil law, may vary from state to state, beginning with the age of 18. The reasons for the parental refusal must be weighed by the pastor against the reasons of the minor for wishing to enter the marriage. If the parental opposition is prudently judged reasonable after questioning and investigation, in other words, because of the immoral or irreligious character of one of the parties, you know, maybe the parents say this guy's a drug addict or this guy is a lecher, they may have some reason to oppose him marrying their daughter. The pastor must dissuade them from the marriage, and if he fails to do so, he must refer all these details to the local bishop. If parental consent is judged to be unreasonably withheld, he should try to win their consent. But if they remain adamant, the pastor may go ahead with the marriage even without consulting the bishop, if the latter, the bishop, has expressed no special prohibition or reluctance. However, civil law must always be kept in mind regarding parental consent and requisite age for marriage. Usually, a diocesan form is available with which to secure and record parental consent. Where the parties have known each other only a short time or know little about each other, so that the pastor fears the lack of a sufficiently solid basis for so important a union, or there is a difference of religion or other factors of disruption, even if premarital pregnancy has occurred, the pastor is to be most prudent in favoring and permitting the marriage and to strive to defer to it. So there are several layers of the church's requirement present there, and I think all of those are pertinent to your question. So does that help, Maria? In other words, it's more than just a simple yes or no answer. There's more to it than that.
Yeah, you know, no, it's very helpful because it gives me rich information about, like, you know, in-depth information about this. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure it's not a yes or no type of question is kind of difficult and it changes depending on the case. So the reason I'm asking this is like, I recently became Catholic less than 2 years ago. And for the reason I became Catholic is because I felt called
to become
a Catholic.
Beautiful.
Thank you. Oh, it's wonderful. And I actually, once I decided to become a Catholic, I went to adult formation classes. And after the formation classes, I realized this is something that we do for the rest of our lives. It's a calling, and it's not something that we must take lightly. Mm-hmm. So,
how were you raised, if you don't mind my asking, Maria? Did you have any faith background?
Yes, I was baptized as a young child. My mom used to take me to church. It was a Catholic church. I'm originally from Uruguay, I feel like it's a little different. But I did grow up believing in God and having a faith in God. I just didn't have a very solid formation. So, but as an adult, I distanced myself from God, and I lived a life of sin. But in my 30s, I realized that it was time for me to come back home. And I met people that told me, you need to come back home. You need to be part of our family. You're loved and you're needed. And I went to adult formation classes, and then it took a year to discern. And I finally took that step, and it's the best thing I've ever done in my life. I'm so happy and so joyful.
I'm happy for you.
But
that's wonderful.
But it's like I feel I have to learn a lot of things about it, and I don't want to disclose too much, and I don't want to steal your time. And
no, I'm here for you.
But
I'm here for you.
I have.
Oh, her phone just dropped. What happened, Cyrus? Cell signal. That's what it looks like.
Aww.
Yeah, well, you know, if
she was really nice.
She was a super nice lady. So if you're listening to me right now and you can, Maria, I think her name was, right?
Yeah, that's right, Maria.
Yeah, so Maria, if you can hear me and you want to call back, I don't know what happened, but your phone just suddenly dropped. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Seraphim, listening in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Seraphim.
Hello, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm an Orthodox Christian. I was wondering about the concept of the Immaculate Conception. I know the Orthodox understanding is that the Virgin Mary led an immaculate life by being brought up young in the temple, and by the grace of God, she committed no personal sins. As far as I understand, that's the Orthodox understanding. And then after the overshadowing of the Holy Spirit, after the birth of Christ, she proceeded to live that way. Our belief is that she would have been subject to death, like a natural death due to the ancestral sin. But my question is regarding the Catholic understanding of the Immaculate Conception, and that if my understanding is correct, that she was born immaculate, and that was kind of a prerequisite for Jesus to be able to be born of her pure. I don't know if that's the full understanding of how the Catholics believe it. But my question is just wondering, if she had to be immaculately born so that Jesus could be born from her being pure,
wouldn't her
my question
have
is,
had
how
to...
was she immaculately born from her parents were not immaculate? So I just wonder, how has that worked out in the Catholic
belief? Sure. I can explain it to you. So first of all, that is not the Catholic teaching. So the church, let's start there. The church does not say that Mary had to be immaculately conceived in order to pass on an immaculate human nature to Jesus. So that mistaken premise, I think, is why the conclusion is inaccurate. Rather, the church says that it was fitting and appropriate that God would give his mother this special grace, this special privilege. That really was a privilege extended to all human beings, beginning with Adam and Eve, but they lost that privilege. Adam and Eve were the first immaculate conceptions. They were created free from all sin by Almighty God, but they lost that. So no, the church does not claim that Mary had to be immaculately conceived, but rather that it was fitting and appropriate. Another little slight tweak, at least as far as the Catholic Church's teaching on this issue is, and that is that it wasn't from the moment of her birth that she was immaculate, but from the moment of her conception. So in her mother's womb, when the sperm and the ovum, when they met and were fertilized, at that moment when Mary began to exist as a person, that's when she was made immaculate by God. So nothing of her own merit. This was something God did for her. And it was unique to her. It did not extend to her parents or grandparents or anyone else. Does that help clarify?
Yeah, that helps me understand that belief better.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
all
it's...
Right. All right, thank you very much.
You're most welcome. It's an area of commonality that we have with Eastern Orthodox folk. And one of the nice things when we have conversation with Orthodox believers is to look for that common ground, because 99% of it, I would say, is common ground. Yeah, there are some areas of serious disagreement on the authority of the Pope, for example, or on the filioque clause, for example, and there are a few others, but there's not much. So I hope and pray, Seraphim, that in due time we will all be united in the same church, God willing. I know Jesus wants that, right? John 17, Father, may they be one as we are one. So I pray that that day will come in my lifetime.
Yes, I pray for peace.
Yeah. Thanks, Seraphim. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to James, listening in Nebraska. Hi, James.
Hello, Patrick. I was calling about something last week. You had said that there's some sins that aren't forgiven by the priests.
No. I was clearing up a misconception where somebody said that. And what I was saying is that there are some penalties associated with certain sins, like, for example, an excommunication that's reserved to the Holy See or reserved to the local bishop. The priest can forgive somebody's sins, but he can't lift an excommunication if he doesn't have the authority to do so. And then I gave a more commonplace example of abortion, which does incur an excommunication, but the priest has the authority. By and large, most priests nowadays have been granted that authority by the bishop so that they can not only absolve this penitent of her sins, but also lift the excommunication in the same act. Does that clarify it more?
Stupid. Yeah, I'm sorry. I have a question about that.
Okay.
I have a question about that, please. If somebody's stupid when they're young and they repeat something that they heard somebody say in confession, can the priest forgive you for that?
Yes. So,
okay.
Let's say that that young person was on the other side of the confessional. Would it be a scenario like that where you couldn't help but whoever it was couldn't help but overhear what the other person was saying?
Yes.
Okay. And then that young person who was stupid and didn't think twice revealed what that person said in confession to some third party?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is no sin that is unforgivable. The unforgivable sin that Jesus talks about is final impenitence, where you reject the Holy Spirit's offer of forgiveness up to the very end of your life and then go to hell as a result. But this is something that the church can and will forgive. So whoever that young person was who made such a bad mistake, and maybe there was some malice involved, who knows, if that person who's probably now grown up were to go to confession and say, years ago, I did this, and confess that, that would easily, readily be forgiven.
Okay, thank you. Stupid and immature.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Been there, done that, James. Not that particular thing. Not that particular thing. But boy, do I remember being young and stupid and reckless and stupid.
Yeah.
And especially stupid. I remember those years very clearly.
Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome, James. See, that's what the beauty of the sacrament of confession is all about, is that there's nothing you can do that God is not willing to forgive as long as you're willing to receive forgiveness. Think of the story of the prodigal son. I mean, he, as you know the story, he demanded his share of the inheritance and he squandered it on riotous living and prostitutes and all of the above. And then when the money was gone and he was living, you know, behind the liquor store next to a dumpster and he had nowhere to go and he had no food, he had hit rock bottom. And he said, the only way I can survive is see if I can go back home and maybe my dad might let me be a servant. And what happens, as you know the story, he goes back home, and when he's still a long way away, the father sees him. And you know what that tells me is that the father was watching for him. The father wasn't like he was in his workshop, you know, and hey, your son's back. The way Jesus tells the story, it gives the impression that the father was actively waiting for him, looking. Maybe you can picture him with his hand, you know, above his eyes to shade from the glare of the sun, looking, scanning the horizon to see, is he coming? Is he? And then he sees him. And then the father, as Jesus tells this beautiful parable, he runs out to where the son is and he welcomes him home. Put a ring on his finger and a cloak on his back and kill the fatted calf and let's have a party, for my son who once was dead is now alive. My son who once was lost is now found. Oh, I just love that story. And it's true for you and me. So no matter what your sins may be, no matter what you may have done or how many times you did it, or you look back and you say, how could I have been so stupid? I can't believe I did that. All right, well, you did that. Then God knows and he will forgive you. So be like that prodigal son and come back home. He's waiting for you. And he'll put a ring on your finger and a cloak on your back and he'll throw a big party because his son or daughter who once was dead is now alive again. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Ruben now in Albuquerque. Hello, Ruben.
Hey, how are you doing, Raymond? I mean, Patrick, sorry.
That's okay.
I just wanted to comment. I apologize. I just wanted to comment on your take on the Georgia election or the Georgia voting.
Okay.
Rules change on voting, and I'm Catholic. You know, I'm mm-hmm. pro-life,
mm-hmm.
I love our new president, and I just feel like, and this is why I called you Raymond, because I think you and Raymond, you know, use this platform to push, you know.
Raymond who? Cardinal Raymond Burke? If you're comparing me to him, thanks for the compliment.
Push it, the right wing side. And, you know, I'm conservative and everything like that, but I feel like, you know, the Georgia, what's happening in Georgia is, Krebs even said it was the most secure election.
Wait a minute. We're not talking about the 2020 presidential election, are we? I thought we were talking about Georgia. Or maybe, did I misunderstand?
You probably did, because I'm talking about what's going on with the election and how in Georgia, they're starting to you know, make sure that, you know, things are going to go a little bit more right. And so they said, well, hey, man, we better change these voting rights.
Well, you know, it was very similar in 2018 when Stacey Abrams lost the governor's race and the Democrats were saying that the election had been stolen because of fraudulent voting. Were they wrong to do that? Were they wrong to say that?
Well, I look at it this way, and you even said it before. You said, you know what? If somebody's other party wins, it is what it is, right?
Right.
And so be it.
Yeah, I accept the election. I mean, if the election is fair and legal, I mean, whoever's elected, if that's the will of the people, I can live with that. I have no problem with that.
Yeah, so and I did with Trump for 4 years, and I looked at all. And come on, man, you got to look at all the stuff that this guy did.
Okay. See, Ruben, we're kind of getting all over the place. I thought you wanted, originally you said I was only taking one side of the issue on the Georgia voting law. Now we're getting into Trump and his peccadilloes. I don't see how that's helpful. I mean, that don't live in the past, man. Live in the present. I live in the present. Why be worried about, you know, those things? We can't change them now.
Wait a minute. You're bringing it up on your platform, which I support now. Okay. And so I'm a Catholic. I love my Catholicism. I love my faith. I will defend
That's good.
It and everything.
But why are we talking about Donald Trump? I mean, it has nothing to do with the Georgia election law. He was not elected He was the president. We're talking about the Georgia state offices.
Yeah.
Not Donald Trump. Well, what does he have to do with it?
Because, you know, that, well, it segues into that because of all the things and the influence he tried to have on those elections. And because, you know, in the end, you know, that state is an electoral state. And then in the end, it dictates how we run the rest of our country for the next 4 years coming up. Right?
Okay, are you okay with the law in Georgia that says you can't bring food or drink to people within 100 feet of a polling station? Are you okay with that?
You know. So I heard your argument on that. That say, say a Trump van pulled up and started, with the hot dogs and beer and hey, and there's plenty of more where that came from. You said that, right?
Right.
And I could see that point. And I want to play both sides. I want to see your side too. And I'm really trying, but I don't see it. And I don't, like I said, I love my Catholicism. I don't want to make this political, but it already is. And I just felt like,
What am I doing wrong then?
I have to say that.
Okay. What, do me this favor, Ruben, because I want to make sure we're on the same page. What do you object to in what I said this morning? What specifically do you object to?
I just feel like it's one-sided. I feel like, you know what, there shouldn't be no, they shouldn't change the voting laws in Georgia. Why not? Why do they have to change them?
How am I being one-sided, though? How am I being one-sided? Well, I mean, if I guess I don't understand what your complaint is.
Okay, my complaint is there was no need to change the way they voted in Georgia, I guess. That's my official stance.
But, you know, 70% of black voters in Georgia were in favor of that law. Are you saying that the 70% of black voters in Georgia should be silenced? Should their voices not be heard?
All right. Okay. Well, I have to, you know what? To be fair to you, I have to research it a little bit more, but it just seems like, you know, we've come out of a rough time right now. And I think that Krebs said, you know, Christopher Krebs, you know, Trump's cybersecurity voting guy or whatever, he said that it was the most security. So I'm just feeling like, why change?
But, Ruben, we're talking about two different things. I hear what you're saying, but I think you're going a couple different directions here. If we're talking about Georgia, keep in mind that the Georgia Democrats in 2018, they were up in arms and saying that the election that Stacey Abrams lost, the election for governor, that election was rigged because there was illegal voting going on. The Democrats were saying, we got to fix things here because our election laws is messed up. So this new law that came in that had the support, I mean, overwhelming support, it seems. And now, something like you got to show a voter ID. They're claiming that's voter suppression. I don't think I'm being one-sided, Ruben. I really don't. But hey, thank you for calling me. I really mean it. And I do hope you'll call me again. God bless you. Happy Taco Tuesday. I'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. By the way, Texas, the great state of Texas, announced this morning that they are banning government-mandated vaccine passports. I don't know if you heard about this. Governor Greg Abbott said, every day Texans return to normalcy as more people get the COVID vaccine. In fact, this week, Texas will surpass 13 million doses administered. Those shots help slow the spread of COVID, reduce hospitalizations, and reduce fatalities. But as I have said all along, this is the governor speaking, these vaccines are always voluntary and never forced. Government should not require any Texan to show proof of vaccination and reveal private health information just to go about their daily lives. That is why I issued an executive order that prohibits government-mandated vaccine passports in Texas. We will continue to vaccinate more Texans and protect public health, and we will do so without treading on Texans' personal freedoms. Now, there's more to this story here. One question that was raised in my mind, first of all, I hail this decision as a good one, if you ask me. But it's interesting because DFW Airport, the home of the great American Airlines, is right there in the middle of the state. And my impression, based upon what I've been seeing in the airline industry news, is that the major airlines are working in that direction to require a vaccine passport of some sort. Now, we'll see how it plays out, and maybe it won't play out that way. But this, I would think, would be a wrench in those gears if it's illegal in the state of Texas now. per this executive order, for the government to mandate a vaccine passport. And if that's the case, I wonder how that would affect American Airlines, not to mention Southwest for that matter. Oh, and speaking of Southwest Airlines, Southwest Airlines just did a major recall of how many pilots, 209 pilots that had accepted a voluntary furlough because of COVID-19 last year. They're being called back as of right now. And this is because the pilots are much more in demand now as they're expanding their routes. All the airlines seem to be doing this. Delta's doing this. American Airlines is doing this. They're recalling pilots. Now, they will return to active status on June the 1st, and that's because between now and then, they've got to go back through all the requalification training requirements. They've got to go through the simulators and do all the health and mental checks and everything that they have to do in any case. But because they've been out of the cockpit for this long, they have to go back through that. But that's great because we want our pilots to be cutting edge in terms of their training and their ability to fly these airplanes. So thankfully, things are coming back, and I'm happy to see it. And I think you are too. Let's go back to the phones now. Let's go next to Catherine, who's listening in Michigan. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I'm wondering about the priest that would not give confession to people that did not have the COVID vaccine. Mm-hmm. Was that a mortal sin for him to refuse confession to those people?
I cannot say whether it was a mortal sin or not. Only God could say that. I can say that pastors of souls, and that's a term the church uses, especially with regard to parish priests, they have a duty, they have an obligation, not only in charity to provide the sacraments when it's reasonable and they're able to do so, but they also, in the case of parish priests, they have a duty in justice to do so. So if it were a visiting priest who happened to be, you know, staying at the parish and he's going to be leaving the following day, he's not from there, and he has to catch an airplane, and you come up and you say, could you please hear my confession? And he says, I'm sorry, I don't have time to do that, but you know what? I might be late for my flight, but I'll go ahead and hear your confession. So he's fulfilling an obligation in charity to do something for you that he's not obligated in strict justice to do. But the parish priest, all other things being equal, if one of his flock comes to him and says, I need the sacraments, I need to go to confession, he has that obligation. So how God judges that, that would depend, of course, on what are the priest's reasons. Does he have some, you know, is he immune compromised? In which case, if he were to contract COVID, would he die? I mean, there are a lot of factors that could go into this. So we can't say yes or no. But to me, it seems as a general principle that for a priest to say, I won't hear your confession unless you've been vaccinated, that that's a dereliction of duty, and that he's failing to fulfill his role as a pastor, as a priest. So how God might judge that, I don't know. I would guess probably negatively. That'd be my take on it, Catherine.
Well, if he was so worried, he should have got the shot.
Maybe he did. I don't know. This is all hypothetical. We know that there, I mean, I talked about at least one incident where this happened. I talked about it on the show. But see, now you're asking a question about the state of his soul before God, and there's no way I could answer that. We can say objectively, that's wrong. That's selfish. We shouldn't do that. But that's different from, you know, presuming to assume whether or not somebody's in the state of mortal sin. That's not something I can do.
Okay.
All right, Catherine. Thank you. Let's go to Chris now in Philadelphia. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Patrick. Just want to say quickly, thank you so much for your morning radio program. Definitely my favorite program on all of Catholic radio.
Thank you.
One thing I wanted to say, Patrick, is thanks for telling things the way they are and for speaking out on our faith as well as you do. And now to my questions. One of them relates to a question that came up a few minutes ago. A young person called up and said he had overheard someone saying something in confession. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to confirm with you, I'd heard another priest say some years back that if that happens, if a person ever overhears something said in confession by another person to the priest, that that person is also bound, like the priest is, by the seal, not to ever mention what he or she heard to anyone else. And I just wanted to, aren't I correct on what I heard?
You are. Now, you are correct, yes. So we have to understand that the church, now I don't want to go too far in saying this, because I'd rather consult a canon lawyer to make sure I'm correct. I believe that the church's law that applies to priests, and the priest would incur severe penalties if he were to tell somebody else what he heard in confession. I don't think that those penalties would accrue to the bystander who happened to hear the confession. But the spirit of that prohibition would be definitely enforced, because if somebody heard another person's confession by happenstance, you know, you're just standing close enough to the confessional and you can hear what's being said, you have a moral obligation not to repeat it. And if you were to repeat it, then you would be guilty of gossip, at least, you know, among other things, possibly a calumny or detraction, by revealing the faults of somebody when you have no right to reveal them. So I think in this case, yes, the person has a moral obligation. I just don't think that it's, and I'd have to check it, but I just don't think that it's stipulated that way in canon law. But yes.
Patrick, one thing you said, I would say to definitely agree with you on that. If a lay person walks by the confessional and maybe hears something that's said, and then if he should not, as you said, morally should not reveal it to someone else, but if he were to say anything to someone else, that being a lay person, that person would not be excommunicated.
That's my understanding. Now, I will defer to a canon lawyer expert on the matter, but based on my understanding, I don't think that that would incur excommunication. No, not the way it would for a priest, but it would not for a lay person, as far as I'm aware. I'm willing to be corrected.
Patrick, I think you just answered my second question. I was going to ask you that I've heard that if a priest ever reveals what's said in confession to anyone else, the penalty is severe, namely it's excommunication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a priest could lose his faculties. The priest could be suspended from the priesthood, and, you know, very possibly would be if that happened.
Patrick, thank you so much for answering my questions, and thank you for telling it the way it is.
You got it, Chris. Thank you. And thanks for listening. I want to tell a quick story, if I may. And Cyrus, stop me if I've already told this story. I'm not sure if I did. Or don't stop me, because I'm going to tell it anyway. I had an incident. This is going back years and years and years ago, many years ago. Somebody I knew had been involved in some pretty, you know, not pretty, some really serious sins. And these were sexual sins, and not of the garden variety type, but, you know, just really serious sins. And so, you know, he calls me up and we have a discussion. And he talks about it. He needed somebody to talk to about it. And so he opened up and he shared with me what was going on. And, you know, I said, how long has it been since you've been to confession? He said, it's been a long time. So I said, well, how about this? Why don't we go to a local parish and, you know, I'll drive and you can get it taken care of. Go to confession and get it off your chest and receive forgiveness. So he said, okay. So he was really heartbroken and feeling really terrible about what he had done. So I drove him up to the local parish, and it was Saturday afternoon, 4 o'clock-ish, 4:15 or something like that. The church was entirely empty. This is a big church, entirely empty, and kind of dark because they didn't have the lights turned on. So it was, you know, the late afternoon shadows. So I knelt in the back of the church praying for my friend, and he went to confession, and the confessionals in this particular church is oddly laid out, but the confessionals in this church are behind the sanctuary. So you go all the way down the center aisle of the church, past the sanctuary, into like another little chapel that's beyond all of that. And then the confessional is way, way back in there, almost as if, you know, they put it back there so you couldn't find it, but whatever. So he goes to confession. And from where I'm kneeling in the very back of the church, I can see there's nobody else in the entire church. So after about 15 minutes go by, my friend comes out of the confessional. And he comes back out, back past the sanctuary, and he turns and he goes into the side of the church that's more or less in shadows because it's late afternoon. The lights are off. So he's kneeling off to the side. Imagine the church is in the shape of a cross. I'm kneeling in the very back by the front doors here. And he comes out and he just goes right to the right and he goes, kneels down in the shadows. And so about 5 minutes later, the red light above the confessional clicks off. The priest comes out. And I know this priest. He knows me. He knows who I am. And so he comes walking out of the confessional and he comes walking all the way down that center aisle. He passes by where my friend was kneeling quietly in the shadows. He doesn't see him there. In fact, he doesn't see anybody in the whole church except for me. So as he walks closer and closer, because he's going to go out, you know, the doors, he walks closer and closer, and I'm there kneeling all by myself as if I had just gone to confession. And so his eyes got wide, and I saw him look at me, and I saw his eyes go wide, and immediately it clicked in my mind. He thinks he just heard my confession.
Oh, he doesn't... Patrick.
Let me hear that one again.
Oh, Patrick.
Yeah. He thought he had just heard my confession. So I'm looking at him. He's looking at me. I'm realizing he's thinking he just heard my confession. He's thinking I just heard his confession. What a fraud. Look at that guy. You know, Mr. Public Catholic and all, you know. And whoa, what he just told me, oh my gosh. But I hadn't gone to confession to him. So he continued. He walked past me. And he never noticed my friend who had just gone to confession to him hiding off in the shadows. And I'll tell you, I was for a moment kind of panic-stricken because I could see it on his face. I said, he thinks that I'm the one that he just talked to. And, you know.
How much of you wanted to be like, pointing at your friend, like, no, it's that guy.
It wasn't me.
It was that guy.
Yes, yes, yes. And so what I was sorely tempted, Cyrus. I'll leave it at this. I was sorely tempted to get up and follow after him and say, Father, 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 Father. Hey, I just want you to know, I did not just go to confession to you. It wasn't me. But then I thought to myself, and this is what stopped me from doing that. I thought, well, you know, Jesus suffered as an innocent man for my sins. He took the penalty for my sins and your sins and everyone else's sins. And he was entirely innocent. And people said evil things about him and thought evil things about him. And he was entirely innocent. If Jesus can do that for me, maybe I can just grin and bear it and suffer the indignity of thinking that that priest thinks that I am a complete fraud, et cetera, et cetera. Now, every other time I've ever seen that priest in the years since then, I've looked to see if he's going to, you know, smirk or anything like that. And he never has. Now, I don't know what he's thinking inside, but, you know, maybe he's forgotten all about it. Some priests say that after they hear a confession, they just forget about it, which is great. I don't know. I kind of doubt he ever forgot that. But I've had to live with it ever since then. But, you know, I can live with that because if maybe he has this mistaken notion of me, and in his heart of hearts, he thinks that I'm, you know, whatever. I can live with that. Maybe in heaven, he and I will get together and I'll say, hey, now I can finally tell you. Remember that one time? And then he'll say, oh, okay. Anyway, so that's my story. That's my the case of a mistaken sacramental identity. Let's take a break, and we'll come back with more of your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. Cyrus, I sure hope that priest is listening to this program, because then he knows the rest of the story.
That's funny.
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Now that's what I call a taco.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Now that's what I call a taco. Happy Taco Tuesday, everybody. This is Taco Tuesday on the Patrick Madrid Show, which means it really doesn't mean anything except we have some Taco Tuesday music. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Carol now in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Hi, Carol. Hello, Carol. Welcome. Howdy, Carol. Welcome to the program. Hey, Carol, you're on the air.
I got a bad feeling about this.
One more time. Hi, Carol.
Alrighty then.
All right. We tried. Five times I tried. So let's see if... Oh, Carol just dropped. Okay. I hope that wasn't a statement, Carol. But, I mean, call me back, okay? 888-914-9149. You waited a long time. Let's go to Mary in Sacramento. Hi, Mary.
Oh, hi. Good morning, Mr. Madrid.
Good morning. How may I be of service?
I just want to say thank you. It's been long overdue that I should have called you. I've been listening to you since 2015 from Immaculate Heart Radio.
Thank you.
I did enroll in one of your class
for
the apologetics. But in 2017, you saved my life. And at work I was bullied, but you helped me out, and I went to confession, and the priest helped me out of that.
Oh, good! I'm happy to hear that.
I'm grateful for that. Yeah.
Praise God.
Yes, praise be to God, and in 2018, I was able to help my sister go back to the Catholic faith. She's been in Islam for 20 years. Mm-hmm. So with your help, with your book, Search and Rescue, that helped me to help her out.
So now tell me, this is your sister, you say. She's been a Muslim for 20 years. What has happened in that case?
I'm sorry?
Maybe I misunderstood you. I thought you said that you knew somebody who had become Muslim. Is that right?
No. She was a Muslim. No, we're Catholic before, and then when she worked in the Middle East, she married an Egyptian, so she has to convert to Islam. So,
but is she still a Muslim now, or did she become Catholic again?
No. She became Catholic in 2018.
Wonderful.
We went to, yes. I read your Search and Rescue book, and I helped her out, tried to be more patient with her and to explain the faith and for her to be able to. And then we went to Our Lady of Good Help, and the priest... she did her first confession again there.
Fantastic.
So when she came back.
Now tell me, what was her husband's reaction to this? What did he say?
Patrick, my brother-in-law passed away when she gave birth 10 days after.
Oh, okay. So he was not alive when this happened. Okay. I see.
No, he was not alive.
Wow.
I know I have a lot of things to ask, but I know I'm just limited to one. And I changed my question. I'm sorry. Question right now is I have a friend that she got involved with a priest, but she's no longer involved right now, and she was able to go confession last year. But until now, she told me that she's having a hard time going back to church because of, because of the priest, and she doesn't, she's having a hard time going,
Okay, let me ask you a couple questions.
Because she knows a lot of
priests. Ask you a couple questions.
Yes.
So she became romantically involved with this priest?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
The priest is gone.
Okay. Gone as in he left the priesthood?
He left the country.
Okay. The U.S. But did he leave the priesthood or is he just on the run?
We don't know.
Okay. All right. So we don't need those details. So your sister became romantically involved with him, which of course is a serious sin and all the problems that are involved there, not to mention scandal. Is she sorry for what she did? Is she ready to come back? And does she want to start receiving the sacraments again?
Yes. My friend was able to go to confession after,
after
I helped
happened.
Her out.
Good. Now, is she feeling a psychological or emotional block with regard to going back to the church because, I'm just guessing here, tell me if I'm right, because when she goes into the church, it brings back all those feelings or all the whatever that are associated with that priest, and she can't quite separate the priest from the Catholic Church? Is that what's going on?
That and also because what this priest was telling her about the other priest,
He was gossiping about the other priests?
Yes.
Okay. Well, this, if nothing else, is a cautionary tale of the horrendous damage that can be wreaked in many different directions when this kind of thing happens. Now, the fact that he was a Catholic priest just adds greater gravity and scandal to the whole thing. So the people are left picking up the pieces, including this woman. So she's been scandalized in more ways than one. Now, she was a participant, so she has her own share in this that she has to account for, but sounds like she's already done that. She's gone to confession. Now she's dealing with the aftermath of the things that she knows, whether they're true or false, and who knows? Maybe the priest was just gossiping and lying, or maybe he was gossiping and telling the truth. So if it seems to me, Mary, that if this is like a particular parish and particular priests, for her own sanity, I would encourage her to just go to a different parish altogether. That way she's not in a situation where she's sitting there at Mass, and as Father so-and-so is celebrating Mass, all she can think of is what this renegade goofball priest told her about that other priest. I mean, we're only human, and we can only deal with our emotions as they are. So to help her avoid that problem, I would just go to a different parish altogether. And hopefully that would
eliminate that. Yes. I mentioned last Sunday because it was Easter, and she opened up to me, and I told her, what if you go to a different church?
I think that's the only way to go, Mary. I'm going to press forward, but first of all, I'm delighted to hear the other parts of your story about your own return to the faith and your friend or your sister, I guess it was, who left and became a Muslim and now is back. Wow. And the fact that my book, Search and Rescue, was helpful to you, that's a double bonus for me. I'm glad to hear that. But in any case, with this other lady, that's what I would suggest. I don't know that we need to get into any more detail except to say that for her own sanity and to return to a sense of normalcy, I would avoid that parish so that she's not thinking about those things. All right. Thank you, Mary. God bless you. Let's go now to, I think we can. Let's go to Carol in Westchester, Pennsylvania, our second Westchester call today. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Patrick. We got disconnected earlier. Anyway, thank you for taking
right.
my call a second time. I was calling in regard to I'm 84 years old. I've been a Catholic all my life. And it just dawned on me the other day when I was praying to St. Michael the Archangel, protect us in battle. Mm-hmm. Why do we address him? It took me this long, I guess, to tune into this. But why would we address an archangel as saint?
Here's why. Because the word saint, now in our modern vocabulary, the word saint, we usually associate it with the men and women who are in heaven. Men, women, and boys and girls. So human beings. And we even think about them more specifically as canonized saints. But really, everybody who is in heaven is a saint. But in a biblical sense, the word hagios, which is the Greek word that we translate into English as saint, that just means holy one. So we look at all of the blessed in heaven as saints. We look at all the angels in heaven as saints. Now, we don't typically talk about the angels as saints, but in that broader biblical context, they are holy ones as well. They're angelic persons, not human persons, but they're holy because they behold God face to face. So the church has a custom of referring to Saint Michael the Archangel, Saint Gabriel, etc. And that's an appellation. Doesn't mean they're canonized saints. It means that we recognize that they're holy and they're in heaven. And that's the simple answer, Carol. I hope that's helpful. Thank you. I'll be right back with Hour 3 right after this.